Okay, I have turned the recorder on. This is Paulina McDougall. I'm in the office with David Sanger, archaeologist at the University of Maine. And we're going to be talking about the Climate Change Institute's history. And at the end of the interview, David, I'm going to ask you to sign a release form, which I have here. So could you tell me a little bit about how you became interested in archaeology in the first place?
Well, I was a undergraduate at the University of New Brunswick, and not knowing what I really wanted to do, and just by accident I got into an anthropology course, and I discovered this is something that I really enjoyed, because it was, you know, it was a social anthropologist, and he was trying to teach us physical anthropology and archaeology. I became fascinated by it, and very soon cleaned out their library, such as it was, on those topics. And Professor McPheat said to me one day, you know, you could make a living at this. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. And he said, yeah, but you have to go to graduate school first. So from there I went to the University of British Columbia. In those days there were only two universities in Canada that were offering graduate degrees with an archaeology specialty. One was Toronto and the other was British Columbia. And I arrived out there to work with Professor Borden, who had never heard of me when I showed up. Because I wanted to continue working on the Pacific Northwest, I applied to a number of universities for a PhD. And they said, oh, fine, come along. But only two, University of Washington and University of Oregon were willing for me to do a dissertation on Northwest Coast archaeology. So I met the archaeologist in charge at Oregon, decided there was no way I could ever work with him, and then went to Washington, and it turned out to be a very good choice.
So how did you end up at the University of Maine?
Well, the Canadian government had supported my research in Canada. And so when they started to expand in the mid-60s, they began looking at, you know, some of the bright young people they'd been supporting over the years, kind of thing. And they offered me a job as their West Coast archaeologist. When I got to Ottawa, I discovered that I'd already been flipped with someone you may know, well, not know of, certainly George MacDonald. He did his dissertation on the DeBert site in Nova Scotia, as you know, and he decided that the Northwest Coast would look more interesting. So when I arrived in Ottawa, in a brutally cold morning, 1966, I guess it was, or 67, I was told, you are now a East Coast archaeologist. Well, you went to UNB, so you know the landscape. Okay, fine. So I stayed there for 5 years. But I was taking out student crews on a regular basis from the University of New Brunswick, the University of Montreal. I was lecturing at the University of Montreal, and I decided, you know, I like being with students more than I like being with administrators. And so I started looking around. And Dick Emmerich, who you know, of course, Paulina, wanted me to come here and replace Dean Snow. Dean, a very nice young man who was here for 2 years, and then he went to SUNY Albany. And but he got things started here. But this was a very small department, and I really couldn't see myself here. And then I got a call from Hal Borns, who said, we're thinking of starting up this institute and would like you to come down and talk with me and George Denton and see what you think. And I'd always been interested in an interdisciplinary approach. I'd worked with geologists on the West Coast. It was an area that interested me. So when I came down and found out that, yes, in a couple of years we hope to go to the administration and get an institute officially blessed, I decided, okay, that sounds like a good spot for me. So I came down here in 1971.
And when you came, was with the understanding that the Quaternary Institute was going to be established but hadn't yet.
Correct.
So how did you develop your research at that time without that? Because I understand that's sort of a joint appointment with Quaternary and Anthropology.
Yeah, well, when I first came down, it was no joint appointment.
Mm-hmm.
It was 100% Anthropology. And I had done several years of research in New Brunswick. So it was easy, of course. There was no border, as you know, in the old days. So I came down here and I inherited Bob McKay. You knew Bob and Gene. And
he was the lab.
He ran the lab. And he'd been doing a bit of introduction to archaeology teaching and really found himself out of his depth. He had a BA and he was not particularly sure of himself in the classroom situation. And I came down here and I found that he and his students had been out at Hirundo and had a very interesting collection already, which tied in very nicely with the Red Oak Cemetery that I had been working on in New Brunswick.
So these were archaic period?
Yeah, late archaic specimens. We now know that some of them went back to the middle archaic too. The stratigraphy is not good there. So we immediately applied for funds to the National Geographic Society and got 3 years of funding for Hirundo. And then I wanted to continue my Passamaquoddy Bay research, so I applied to National Science Foundation and built in palynology and sea level rise into that grant. So I had both the coastal and the interior thing going right from the get-go.
And we're already adding the other disciplines to your research.
Mm.
Who did you get involved
with? The sea level rise had never been done before around here. And I got Hal involved in that. And he had a grad student, a chap by the name of Thompson, who went out there and looked at some submerged forests in the Lubeck area, and I'd been interested in vegetation change as an insight into climate change, and Ron Davis had come here the year before I did, so he agreed to participate in that, and we took some cores down east and began to work in those three elements, the geology, the archaeology, and the palynology.
So it sounds like one of the reasons you were particularly intrigued by the Quaternary Institute was the opportunity to do this sort of interdisciplinary project programs. Now,
correct.
Did that create any problems for you with anthropology?
No. When I came, the anthropology department was already, I believe it's true to say they were unique in the old College of Arts and Science, in that we all had a 2+2 teaching load. Dick Emmerich apparently went in to see the dean at one point and said, I think we should do 2+2, and the dean said, okay.
But what does that mean exactly? I mean,
2 courses each semester.
Okay. And how is that unusual?
Yes. A more normal load at that time was 3 and 3 or 3 and 2. And I'd had enough experience to realize that when you do 3 and 3, there's not too much chance for research. 2 and 2, okay. Especially once you've got the courses going. 3 and 3, killer. So I was 100% anthropology, and we have to jump ahead a little bit now, because when the Institute was officially formed, what the old personnel action forms had to be redone. And during that summer, Hal initiated the forms. By that time, he'd been appointed by President Libby as the director of the Institute. He sent them over here, and Dick Emmerich, bless his heart, never looked at anything he signed. And he just signed his name, sent the forms back, and in doing so, gave away two-thirds of my position in anthropology. I was more than a little upset. And it was agreed. If this didn't work out, we could pull back the forms and I could go back 100% anthropology. It didn't make much difference to the department, except that I taught one less course. Even still, I was teaching way more than the other people in the Institute. So I teach two courses one semester and one the next, with the expectation I'd be getting involved in graduate work somewhere in the future. And in those more naive days, we were not so concerned about actual number of positions in the departments. It wasn't all that difficult to add a new member if you could justify it. Funds weren't as tight in those days. So there may well have been colleagues who said, how come Sanger's not teaching as much as I am? But it never came to me if that was the situation. So I would say that, had I been chair at the time, I never would have signed that without a lot of questions. But Dick Emmerich just signed things, mm-hmm. and that's all there was to it.
So he was open to people doing more research and kind of supported that?
Very interesting paradox. If you talk to Jim Acheson, you would hear that Dick Emmerich didn't want anyone to have anything to do with research. He never once made a comment to me about doing research. Though I know he and Jim Acheson had some, had some bad times over it. Dick himself didn't do research, as you probably know. Sandy, of course, was working on things. And Ann Acheson, then Ann Tamarkin, was trying very hard to finish up a PhD, so she was tied up. Jim Acheson was getting his research going on the coast. So I think Dick was pleased that I was doing research, taking students out in the summer, getting the anthropology department in the newspaper for, covering digs and so on. Mm-hmm. So I never experienced any reticence to support me as I needed for research.
Now, I understand that from Hal, that one of the expectations of those who became part of the Institute was that they would bring in significant research funds and in that way support their own research. Mm. Was that your understanding in the beginning?
Yeah. I knew the university had no money to support research. So that's why I went to the National Geographic, why I went to NSF. Yeah.
What do you think has been the now Climate Change Institute's greatest contribution in terms of findings?
Findings is difficult. As you know, when we started off, it was a very small group, and it was very easy to be very much aware of what each other was doing. There were lots of seminars. When we brought in outside speakers, we all went to all the seminars. It was a very tight-knit group. There were two levels involved. On the campus level, we soon developed a reputation for, if you want to start an interdisciplinary institute, go and see what Hal Bourne's and the Quaterni have done. And that's always been kind of a model held up, except that initially, many departments were not willing to have shared salary lines, which always gave the Institute a cohesiveness that many other just loose affiliations of people didn't have. Some of us more dependent on the contributions of others. As you know, in archaeology, you can't very well do your own geology, you can't very well do your own vegetational history. You've got to depend on other people. Other folks really didn't need that kind of interdisciplinary effort from folks locally. So George Denton tended to work with people all around the world, depending on where he happened to be working. So interdisciplinary work, yes, but he wasn't dependent on people on campus here to do that. And I found out very early that it's a lot easier to do interdisciplinary work when you can just call up and say, let's have a cup of coffee and talk about, if that person is in California and we'll see you at the next conference. It doesn't work, you know. Maybe you can ship a paper over and comment on the paper, but really sitting down and talking about things. So I think that ability, I had that because I was working locally, and Hal was working locally, Ron Davis was working locally, and then George Jacobson came along and was working locally, and they had students who were doing Maine Northeast work. I really had that advantage, and I like to think I, you know, really took advantage of it. Mm-hmm. And the same with when I got working on the coast and the oceanographers. So I think I remember the first time I went down to NSF and I talked to the program manager, who at that time was a social anthropologist. I guess still is, in effect. This is a different one. And he said, an institute. Interdisciplinary. Everyone says that. Tell me, what is your social organization? Is it just held together with a paperclip? Or are you people really working together? And when he heard that, you know, salaries were involved, I think that piqued his interest quite a bit. So I think we were fairly, as far as Northeastern archaeology goes, there weren't too many people who were attempting to bring together palynology and sea level rise and things like that. In fact, I guess there were none when it comes right down to it. Especially not building it into the research before you even go into the field. I think it's common for archaeologists to do their work and then follow, oh, let's see, we've got some soil samples. Who can analyze the soil samples? Or we made a habit, developed a methodology of building all of that in before we started going into the field. And I think that was a contribution, the methodological contribution. But, you know, in terms of what the Institute was doing, we had a strong Antarctica program. Hal and George Denton had worked in the Arctic. We had a grad student here, Vibion Carlin. I don't know if you remembered Vibion. He married Jesse Kolb, K-O-L-B, and Jesse and you might have overlapped, I'm not sure. He was a physical geographer from Sweden, and they did some very good things together. So, various people did their own thing, but they were always there to assist and answer questions if you had them. In fact, George Denton and I had a program that was about ready to go up in the Canadian Arctic, but it fell down on permitting issues at the last minute with the Canadian government. So people were very willing to be interactive and help out in a lot of ways.
It sounds like one of the areas that the Institute has been very strong in is in Maine prehistory.
Mm.
Would you like to comment about that?
Well, it's local. And it's so much easier for us to do archaeology in Maine than it is for Dan Sandweiss to go down to Peru. We don't have to worry about permits, we don't have to travel so far, you know. It's just a whole lot easier. And as you know, there's a good archaeological resource here. So it's the reason why I deliberately didn't try and start up in a new part of the world somewhere, which is too easy to do it here. And the work needed to be done. Our understanding of Maine pre-European history was pretty weak in the early 1970s. You know, some basic outlines, yes, but we didn't even know there were actually Paleo-Indians in Maine at that time. That took a while to come along. So there was lots of things to develop. You know.
How do you think that geology and paleoecology research in Maine has assisted your understanding of archaeology?
You probably remember that the term we use for the last 10,000 years is the Holocene, and most people think, well, the Holocene means things haven't changed. And one of the first things, the more we began to look at the paleoecology, the geology, began to see sea level rise especially, things have changed a lot. The river systems were not fully integrated at the end of the Paleo-Indian period. They continued to develop. Major shifts in water coming down the Kennebec and cutting off parts of the Penobscot and things like that. So a lot of those details we simply didn't know anything about. Water levels in rivers. Why was it we're only finding, you know, ceramic period remains in many of the upstream areas? Well, I think the water levels are so low that access to those areas was really limited until about 3,000 years ago. And as you know, people had to be able to canoe those rivers. Fish had to be able to get up those rivers. And then in an earlier time, we had the hemlock decline around 4700 BP, and that just really opened up vegetation. Well, the marsh foods brought in a lot of the animals that people really need to live on, whereas the hemlock forests are pretty sterile. So there were, I thought you could make some cases for changes in the environment and human responses. Not one-to-one, of course, but when you're talking about being able to get up certain rivers and at a certain time, that, you know, opens up whole new landscapes to people. And I thought those were important things.
Is there anything that you would like to point to that you feel is maybe one of the most surprising or significant things that you've learned over the last so many years that you've been doing archaeology in Maine?
Well, I know you're not asking this the way many people ask it, you know, what jade idols did I find? Or,
yeah.
We just don't get that in Maine.
No.
I think it's an incremental thing. You build up little by little, and the picture just gets more and more complete, and that allows you to take a jump into something else. And certain things I keep coming back to. I just published a paper, for example, again on swordfish, which I hadn't visited since 1975, that Arctic anthropology paper. And now, to understand the history of the swordfish and the late Archaic people on the coast really demands that you get into not only swordfish behavior, but also currents, sea level temperatures, sea levels and temperatures. It's a whole series of things that go together. And when they all come together and you make a story out of them, there's no eureka moment. It's just these all seem to hold together pretty well. And then you throw it out there and you hope that your colleagues will believe you.
Well, I understand there have been some disagreements over the years among archaeologists about how to interpret various findings, of course.
Yep.
One of the things that I'm interested in that you have written about is the idea of there being maybe different adaptations to the interior and to the coast in different time periods. Mm. Can you summarize that a little bit, just briefly for us?
I think in parts of central Maine coast, and that would include, I think, the Penobscot Valley, instead of a single population moving back and forth as Ekstroman laid out and Spec afterwards, that there was an interior population and a coastal population. And trying to show that archaeologically was quite difficult given the lack of preservation in the interior. As you know, you have coastal clans and interior clans. Was this something that went back in time? Were the dialectical differences that went back in time? So I started looking a little more closely into that and trying to see, could I get at that archaeologically? Well, one of the things is, if people were on the coast only in the summer, there shouldn't be any winter sites on the coast. And I began finding winter sites on the coast based on the, you know, fauna remains. So, since I posed the question back in, I don't know when it was, but if we had people living on the coast, sites being occupied the year round, then who was living in the interior? And that's when I started to realize, I first published on that in the 90s, that more likely than not, there were people who spent most of their year in the interior estuaries and embayments, and then there were folks that most of their year further upstream. But I always suspected they came together at places like Eddington Bend or others where, you know, you could get together for the rendezvous, the exchange of partners and trading and that kind of thing, which is going to keep a certain amount of homogeneity in the area, but still, people would know that home is up here, home is down here. Mm-hmm. And the more I worked on that, the more it seemed to carry through, not only in seasonality, but also perhaps in attitudes towards disposal of animal remains. Coastal people seem to have they allowed dogs to chew bones. They were not burning bones. There was some burned bone, but it seemed more accidental than deliberate, whereas in the interior, it's obviously heavy burning of bone, which makes more sense in terms of what the Cree were doing and what some of the early ethnographers recorded for in New Brunswick and Nova Scotian area. And it's even there in Spec, if you can see it. And I felt this was more of an interior pattern. Coastal folks didn't seem to have this concern. They let the dogs chew the bones, for example. Mm-hmm. So I thought there was enough there to... And then Jim Peterson went into cordage twist. And at times when cordage was important on pottery, there seemed to be an interior pattern and a coastal pattern. Mm-hmm. So there was an artifactual difference.
To explain to Adam and others who might be listening to this, cords are twisted and pressed into the wet clay to make a design on a piece of pottery. And so if they're twisted in one way, the design would go in one direction. If they're twisted in the other way, they would go in the other direction.
And this is a motor habit that you learn when you're a youngster. So you roll it on your thigh this way, or you roll it on your thigh that way. You don't mix it up, because Mum would pretty quickly say, no, that's not the way to do it. We do it this way. And it seems pretty picky, but it's held up reasonably well since Jim's early work on that. Brian did something on projectile points at one point that seems to follow the same the same line.
Brian Robinson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very interesting. I think that's clearly you've learned a lot over the years from back in the late 70s or even the 60s when you started to now. You know, how does archaeology contribute to climate change information?
I don't think it does very well. It was the hope of a number of archaeologists that you could go from one to the other. I did a paper with Andy from Baker Crawl and Heather Almquist in a volume that Dan Sandweiss edited, in which I pointed out that because of the human nature, hunters and gatherers especially have the ability to roll with the punches. And I quoted some of the work of Frank Speck indicating that when an area got over 100, people would move over into another area, usually following some kind of kin lines. But so human beings have this ability to reorganize themselves on the landscape on a time scale that we cannot possibly pick up in the archaeological record. We're dealing in centuries, they may be dealing in decades at the most. So, in the case of Maine archaeology, and I would suspect almost any sort of temperate area like this, trying to go from the archaeology to climate change is a stretch. I think so. We have been able to make contributions, I think, to geology. Sea level rise studies. There's a record of sea level rise studies in the archaeological record, which Hal and I agree on, but Joe Kelly and Dan Belknap do not. They take all their data points and they smooth them off with a curve. And the question I have for them was, I've got a site on the coast, guys, and the bottom level's 2,000 years old, and then there's 1,000 years old, and then there's people just before the Europeans came. And if your sea level curve is right, 2,000 years ago, these guys were sitting back a mile in the woods, waiting for the sea to come to them. For people who are oriented towards the ocean, makes no sense at all. So how could you get a stratified site with people living on the same strand line if there was not a big still stand? And then up she goes and we begin to see the rapid erosion. That's because I'm taking the individual data points and they're rounding the curve. So Hal and I continue to talk about this, and I just know that our other colleagues in geology, as far as they're concerned, they've published their smooth curves, and that's the story. But I do think that when someone comes by back again, takes an independent look, especially at sea level rise down east, and really thinks about the archaeological implications of these stratified sites on the coast, and then the very rapid erosion of them in recent times, they will see that things were not a nice linear line, that there's a lot of wiggles. And you may remember in global sea level rise, you've always had the people at Fairbridge who were talking about wiggles, and other folks who just wanted to see it sort of a straight line change. So I'm a wiggle person as opposed to a straight line. So that was one area, I think, that and then working closely with Alice Kelly in the interior. When I first started doing my work in the interior, Hal Bourne said, well, you know, ever since the ice went out, Penobscot River and its tributaries have been in an erosional cycle. Well, we found out that that's again a matter of scale. As we started working around tributaries, we found that there's very much aggradational system going on, so that we had in some places 3 meters of stratified archaeological deposits interspersed with flood events. Well, you can't date the flood events very well, but you can date the archaeological strata. So we were providing the chronology for changes in the rivers in these distinctive areas where there was localized damming going on through bedrock sills and a major tributary and the main branch coming in. So I think we went, because of the archaeology, from the whole thing is in an erosional cycle and you won't find any stratified sites here, to yes, there are lots of stratified sites, but within 100 meters of certain geological features, which we recognized and took from there, and we could provide the chronology. So in terms of the history of deposition in the rivers, we have the technique to date that and point out major gaps in the record, big flood events, people weren't living there. Things settle down, a forest soil develops, people come in and live there and leave their site in charcoal for us to date. So I think that was, again, on the local scale, a contribution to the geology. As for the paleoecology, no, we can't do. Can't do very much there except to encourage people to take lots of pollen diagrams. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing of lake levels, that came about because I got the funding to have Heather Almquist Jacobson look at the little pond up here, Mansell Pond, and provided the radiocarbon dates and the resources for her to do the analysis and show that there was a significant period of lower water. Well, I've always known during the hypsothermal or middle Holocene things were hotter and drier, but how much hotter and drier? She had all the techniques and the hard work. I just had the cash for it. And the encouragement, we published a number of papers together on it. So we could see this is why it's important to the archaeology. This is where the archaeology helped towards the paleoecology. So yeah, you can see those kinds. But actual climate change, I would say, no.
Well, one of the things that I've heard from other folks is that maybe one more significant change that's taken place recently or discovery is the understanding that climate can change very rapidly, more rapidly than we thought before. And that certainly sounds like something that might have an impact on archaeological findings as well, or that you might even be able to identify in some cases. And I was wondering about those sea level changes, if that is another area where rapid change in climate could impact that.
It could. You've got climate change on the larger scale leading to eustatic sea level rise, melting of the ice caps. But I think more important for the coast of Maine is a localized signal dealing with the subsidence of the coast, and especially prominent in Passamaquoddy Bay. So again, I think the contributions, and much less so in Penobscot Bay. So I think the contributions we're making there are more to the geology. And the geology, I think, is explicable in terms of lineaments and a lot of earthquakes at one time with shifting going on along the coast of Maine, as opposed to major climatic events. Now, you can always, there's a lot of sloppy thinking that goes on in some of these areas. Line up the events here, line up the events here, you look across and you say, aha, correlation. Well, may not be. And I think it's a really hard burden to show. You can show the collations. This is happening here, happening here. Maybe they're related. If your site is overrun by a glacial advance, well, you know. But even still, why is the glacier advancing? What caused the Younger Dryas? I'm not going to get at that archaeologically. Someone else has got to come up with that kind of explanation. So I suppose I was more optimistic 30 years ago than I am now in what terms of what could be done.
Well, a lot of work has been done. Have you found through your career that you've had good support financially from grants and so on for your work in archaeology? And has being part of the Climate Change or Quaternary Institute helped that?
I think so. Especially in the early days when we were trying to establish the methodology and reputation building, I think it was important. But later on, when I really wanted the help for the kinds of things I was doing, I found myself not going to the founding members of the Institute. They were mostly too busy. My strategy was to pick a young postdoc. Well, for years I worked with Alice Kelly while she was doing geology for me in the field, and then she eventually massaged that into her PhD dissertation. I think the most significant work we did with looking at the ground stone materials up here at Gilman Falls. Alice found a young postdoc who did his dissertation in the right kinds of rocks in Maine. I was able to hire him for a year to produce a really spectacular report on the rocks that were being used at the site, where they came from, so on and so forth. Worked with Heather, worked with Andy from Baker Craw. They were not people who were faculty members. They didn't have full-time appointments and lots of other commitments. They were willing, I had the money, they were willing to work for a year. They were, professional people, excellent training. I sometimes felt a little bit guilty, but not too much. We published together, and that's the important thing, that they got credit, I think,
sure.
For what
I'm
they
sure
did.
It was very mutually advantageous for them as well.
Yeah.
Helpful careers.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. So you develop a methodology, and I had written some of the charter members into a couple of grants, and they never really came through for me. Yet I know that having their names on the proposals was probably helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get to a level where you can fly on your own, and then you can build in other people who do have the time and so on and the inclination to get involved. So I would say it sort of shifted through time.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about, you've been to the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arctic is very, an environment that's not particularly friendly to humans, although occupied it, but did you find it more challenging to work there? And if so, what were some of the challenges that you had to face?
Well, the field work that I did in the Arctic, I was really moonlighting. I was working as a geologist. And because we had daylight 24 hours a day and a fair amount of time off, I could go around looking at archaeological sites. But I couldn't do any significant work there. I also worked with Arctic collections, so I was not involved in the actual excavation of them, but analysis of them, particularly microblade analysis. So Personally, the challenges were not great because I was not really devoted putting in full field seasons. But those people that were, and I knew a number of them because they were, and many of them came from Canada, back in the 70s and even into the 80s, it was very difficult logistics. Now, people, you know, there are tourists dropping in on your site, and it's changed completely. Back in the early days, it was a lot more challenging to do things. And the archaeology being done now is much better because in those days, decisions had to be made as to what you brought out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of bones just got left behind. Never,
right.
Never came back for analysis. It was just too much weight to put in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not a... was not an issue for the kind of work I was doing.
Have there been any changes in actual techniques that we use in the field in time, or tools or methods of expedition or anything like that?
Yeah, sort? I think the major thing was back in 1989, I got the, here's where a place where the university did help me out. They invested in a total station for me, survey station. And there was no one else in the Northeast using this equipment then. And I, the conference in Tucson, and I happened to go down to the book room and saw a young man standing there by himself beside a transit. I started chatting with him. It turned out he was developing an archaeological, a program for gathering data on an archaeological site. All the data collectors at that time were designed for survey engineers. And he asked me if I'd like to become one of his beta testers, and I indicated I would. So then I went and talked with Ray Hintz and got Ray involved, you know, Ray in engineering, surveying. And so this changed things completely. At Eddington Bend, with the big features, we were able to, you know, a number of readings around the outside of each feature, and as we went down, you know, by 5 centimeter lifts, take continuous readings down, and then put the whole thing in an AutoCAD program and just print out these beautiful diagrams of the features and how they change through depth and so on. And artifact plotting, it did away with so many inches this way or so many centimeters that way, it just bang right into the computer. Downloaded it every night, and ready to go the next day. So excavation became much more accurate and much easier in the sense of being able to go directly from the transit to the computer. No translating in between. That I think was a major kind of a change. Otherwise, most of the techniques we use were pretty much standard, you know. You excavate in squares and certain depths and, you know, I came down believing you screened and samples for fine screening, and I think I was the first to use column sampling in the Northeast here. We, you know, bring the stuff back and really shake it down and look at the details of that. So little things to try and make it get a little more data out of the ground, and, you know, not just the arrowheads, kind of speak. Tried an early program of soils chemistry with Victor Conrad out of Colorado. So trying to bring in as much as we could to enhance the data recovery.
Mm-hmm. Another area I think I've observed is a greater involvement with the Native community. Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Yeah. I think most archaeologists, by 1970, pretty much had taken the attitude, well, yeah, there are some Native people around, isn't that interesting? But they don't have much to tell us. After all, Christianity came in here, changed everything. And my first real in the West Coast, I had a lot of experience with Native people because I could talk to people who were born in these semi-subterranean houses. And I had to talk them through an interpreter. And so I was very much aware of what you could do with that kind of a direct historic approach. When I came back here to the East, I wasn't aware of that until I got involved in that Red Oak Cemetery up in New Brunswick. And the idea that the local Native people might be sensitive to this never occurred to me. It certainly didn't occur to my bosses in Ottawa, and it should have. And then when I came here to Maine, I got to know Ted Mitchell very well. And Ted was provided me with a great education. And the more experience I got, the more I realized, well, yes, superficially, the Native people have lost a lot. But down deep, they've retained a lot. And then that became far more important from a point of view of my understanding their sensitivities and them educating me. So that was important, definitely.
Did you ever see yourself as an explorer? Did you ever imagine yourself as being...
Yeah. I sometimes stand at a site when I had time to reflect on things, watch everyone else working away. So, you know, I'm so fortunate. No one else has seen this slice of history since 5,000 years ago, whenever it was. And I'm fortunate enough to be here to do that and have the techniques to recover part of that. So I saw I saw myself every bit as an explorer, as a guy going off into space or going underwater, you know, climbing a hitherto unclimbed mountain. It was all new. And I think for that reason, I really felt this information has to get out, either through students or in the written word, because there are other people out there who are interested. And so definitely, I saw there were times when I really felt that.
Did you engage much with the history of the region when you were, trying to figure out how to put your archaeological data into some kind of a context, or the earlier archaeologists' work, that sort of thing?
Well, in terms of what we typically call history, in terms of European written records, no, I never did any historical archaeology in this part of the world. That's that one of the reasons why I went out and recruited Rick Faulkner. So, Rick, that's yours. I don't want to get involved. Interesting, but no, I can't do that. So I never had any ambitions to tie the archaeology of the pre-European period with the historic Britain historic period, and I never really. I spent a lot of time going through the early chronicles. My dad is an archaeologist in the Northeast who was, including Bruce, who's looked as closely as I have at Champlain and a lot of the French people in the Canadian provinces. I was looking for very specific things, like what kinds of animals were they seeing? And not always what was that animal translated to by Ganong or somebody else, but going back to the Rus and seeing what did they mean by 16th century term or 17th century term. I spent a lot of time, but again, I was trying to find analogs and information on wildlife patterns and that kind of thing that I could use in my interpretations. I was not really trying to go the other way at all.
I think I would, at this point, just ask you if there's anything that you'd like to put on record that maybe I didn't think of, that you were looking forward to telling me, or...
I don't think I have had anything very pressing. Now, as you know, because the Institute was successful and because archaeology had a reasonably high profile within it, we were able to add more archaeologists, which Rick and then Rob came along, and then when Rob left, there was no talk about not replacing him, so we had to go and get Chris. And then Dan came along, that was a EBSCO. So the administration was always very supportive. And it's one thing for them to say nice things, but when they say, oh, here's a new archaeology position. So then I think that did raise a little bit of antagonism, perhaps, with the department, certain members of the department. Many of them come out of an anthropology department where you might have had 10 social anthropologists for one archaeologist, and we turned that model on its head. So we had, you know, there were more archaeologists running around here than there were social anthropologists. That's not the case now.
Isn't it?
No. They never replaced Rick Faulkner.
Right.
I think they are not going to replace Catherine. I'd be surprised if they did.
But we have two new people coming on board.
Social.
They're both social.
So that leaves, in terms of teaching faculty members, Brian and Greg. So we're down quite a bit in terms of where we were at one time. You know, they did replace me. A lot of departments, people have retired. You know, you really don't need that Latin Americanist. You can get by without it, can't you? You will get by without it. So the administration, I think, has been very supportive. And I know. Do you remember the name Paul Uttermark?
Yes.
Yeah, he was the director of sponsored programs
That's
for a number of years.
Yeah.
And one of the things Paul liked to do, he had all these statistical formulas he liked to use. And he told me once, I just don't understand anthropology department. Most departments that come out high on the money have small student loads. Anthropology, you have high student load, lots of majors, you bring in lots of money, publish a lot, it doesn't compute, you know. And even though, so we were kind of, he viewed us as oddballs, but in good oddballs. And if only more departments were doing that. And I think that's always been something that's I think the old institute can take a lot of credit for that, because it really helped to build anthropology. And using, you know, Hal was a very persuasive guy, and he'd go to the administration and he would talk up, this is what we need, and he usually got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the Institute in that respect was really instrumental in building certain aspects of the anthropology up. And so there was that kind of symbiotic relationship going there. We had most of the students. You know, for a long time we had nearly all the grad students
mm-hmm.
in the archaeology side of things. Those blue books down there are theses that and I don't think there's any other faculty member in the Institute has anywhere near that number of graduate theses. So when you want that measure, okay, we look okay. You want the measure of a lot of undergraduates, anthropology looks okay. Add up all the funding, looks good. So it balances out nicely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Well, thank you very much, David.
My pleasure.
It's been enjoyable, and I appreciate you spending a hot afternoon with us.
You're very welcome.
I'm going to stop the tape recorder now.
Yep.